From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, women and college athletics as Eastern settles with two former players.
Nobody wants to cut back. Nobody wants to see men cut back. I don't want to see the football budget cut back. But are there areas that we can trim the fat to make room for everybody?
Also on the show, Tesla wins the right to sell its cars in Michigan and service them in shops closer than Toledo. A case before the U.S. Supreme Court offers possible signposts to Michigan's debate for public funding for private schools. And we consider the less glamorous side of organizing. Sometimes changing the world involves taking a hard look at the goalposts.
Anytime you're trying to change structures of power, there's always really, really intense resistance. There's always lots of compromising.
This and other truths about the cost of activism. All those stories and more coming up on today's show. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, the dispute over Michigan's ban on public funding for private education. We'll talk about a case that tests Michigan's constitutional ban on spending taxpayer money on private schools. And we'll hear how a Montana case argued before the U.S. Supreme Court today might influence Michigan's highest court. But first, Michigan's cleared the way for Tesla to sell more of its cars right here in the backyard of the Big Three. Tesla had sued the state of Michigan, challenging a 2014 law that ensured automakers could only sell through independent franchise dealers, not directly to customers. But that suit's just been settled by State Attorney General Dana Nessel. Here's Nessel spokesperson Kelly Rossman McKinney explaining part of the deal.
So this gives them a little bit more flexibility. They have a what they call a gallery in Somerset Place in the Detroit area. And the difference between a gallery and a dealership is in a dealership, they've got vehicles in stock. You can test drive them right there, and you can actually drive away from the dealership in a brand new car. That is not the case with galleries. Current law did not, or at least Tesla was under the impression they couldn't place an order at the gallery for a customer, and now this will allow them to do that.
And as a bonus for current Tesla owners, the company will now be able to set up service centers for their vehicles. Mike Martinez covers Tesla for Automotive News. Mike, hi, how are you?
Doing well, thanks for having me.
Can you explain a little bit how all this works? How can a car be bought in Michigan but not actually titled in Michigan?
Well, essentially, when you have the sale contract through whatever entity you buy it through, you can transfer that. You know, you can have that take place in another state and then just simply transfer that to Michigan after you take delivery of it. So that's how Tesla is going to go around this law. They'll be able to sell vehicles here in Michigan. Prior to this, you know, if you lived here and you wanted to buy one, you had to go down to Cleveland. You had to go down to Columbus. But now you're going to have the opportunity to do it right here in Michigan. And a big part of this, as you mentioned at the top, is the service centers as well. You can have your car serviced directly here in the state. I know there was a center that opened in Toledo, Ohio, not too long ago. That was kind of the closest one. So this makes it a whole lot easier for people who want to own a Tesla.
Will you recap for us what the dealers who opposed Tesla's infringement were concerned about and why it took so long to get their concerns addressed and settled?
Well, the dealers, you know, as they have for, you know, dozens and dozens of years, have this business model where they're, you know, essentially the middleman with the automakers, and you can't sell a vehicle here unless it's through a franchise dealer in partnership with, you know, the various companies, Ford, GM, Chrysler, et cetera. And Tesla has disrupted that entire business model, that entire way of doing things, and they just sell their stuff directly to the customers, no middleman involved. And so they've been fighting it. It's not just here in Michigan. This is a battle that's played out throughout the country. I believe Tesla sells direct to customers in about half of the 50 states. So in these other states, you're seeing similar battles. So what they were able to do here in Michigan, it's an absolutely big win for Tesla. You may see this start to play out in some of these other states. You may see more of these same types of settlements that allow them to sell and service directly through a subsidiary.
Mike, do you have any sense of why the state of Michigan decided to settle this case?
I don't. It's a little unclear. You know, we still are reporting out on things as they happen yesterday and today. But again, it's a big win for the company. You would assume it could help spur sales and economic development here in the state. You know, I know the dealers have their reasons for not wanting Tesla. The automakers may not want to have that extra competition. But at the end of the day, it's good news. If you're in the market for a high-end electric vehicle, you can get a Tesla now.
I can almost hear current Tesla owners breathing a sigh of relief over those repair centers, which, again, will be allowed as long as they're owned by a Tesla subsidiary. I imagine the difficulty in getting a vehicle to someone who could repair it was a bit of a damper on Tesla sales in Michigan, right?
Oh, for sure. It was definitely a barrier. And, you know, you look at Teslas and you look at the technology inside of them, you know, some repairs can be done over the air through software updates, so you don't necessarily need to be in a service center. But when you take a look at a vehicle, whether it's a problem with the tires or suspension, whatever it is, it was a hassle to have to get down to Toledo or elsewhere in Ohio. And quite frankly, for anybody in Michigan to have an excuse not to go to Ohio is always a good thing.
Would you expect Tesla to try to expand who can work on its cars in Michigan anytime soon?
That remains to be seen. They're going to set up this subsidiary called Tesla Michigan. I believe there were some filings today. It's going to be run by a Tesla general counsel. So I think it's still unclear, you know, how quickly they'll be able to get up and running, you know, physical service centers here in the state. So you never know if they could partner with others who already have existing buildings and facilities. That remains to be seen.
What do we know about consumer demand for Teslas in these parts? I mean, obviously, they've got huge name recognition, but they're far from the only player in their class for electrification.
They're not the only player, but they're the dominant player right now. You look at states like California, they're ubiquitous. They're on the road. Every other car is a Model 3 or a Model S. Here in Michigan, not so much. It's still important to keep in mind that electric vehicle demand is still low. They make up a fraction of new vehicle sales every year, about 2%. But within that 2%, Tesla absolutely dominates. You obviously have examples like the Chevy Bolt EV. You have the Ford Mustang Mach-E coming later this year. So you're starting to see some of the established automakers try to challenge Tesla, but for now they really have a stranglehold on the EV market.
Did we learn anything through this settlement about the political power of traditional car dealers in Michigan right now, possibly being on the decline?
Well, you could infer that. I mean, the dealer body, their advocacy groups have had a very high influence over the automakers, over the state in particular, and how things are done. So to see this change, it is a bit of a blow for them. It remains to be seen if it'll be a material impact to the average dealer in Michigan. I'm not quite sure that they're going to suffer too much to have some more competition here. But this is really challenging and disrupting decades-old laws and ways that they've done things.
Mike, thanks for checking in. Good talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Martinez covers Tesla for Automotive News. Eastern Michigan University has settled a lawsuit with former student-athletes in some of its women's sports programs. The student plaintiffs allege that budget cuts to softball and tennis programs 2 years ago violated Title IX. That's the legislation that requires federally funded schools to provide opportunities for women in sports. The school has agreed to pay two former players, including a softball player, and to invest $2 million for women's sports programs, but the EMU softball team is no more. Carol Hutchins is the powerhouse head coach of the University of Michigan women's softball team. I asked her how significant she thought the loss of the EMU team is for women athletes in the region. Have you been following the lawsuit over Eastern Michigan's elimination of several sports, including softball?
Well, I certainly followed it, although you just apprised me that they had just settled with it and they were no longer going to be held to reinstating the program.
The school has agreed to several remedies, including payments to one former Eastern softball player and $2 million in funding for women's sports, but softball is not coming back. What kind of loss is that in your view?
Well, obviously, anytime there's a loss of opportunity, period, it's sad. It's unfortunate. And obviously for our sport, we certainly consider softball to be one of the premier sports for women in the NCAA. But it's opportunities for young women who have an interest in what we do. And paying off one or two players, there's a lot of women who've been denied opportunities. So that'll be interesting to me to see how many other lawsuits they've opened the door to have to settle.
Yeah, the university's argument when it eliminated the softball program was that it would prefer a women's lacrosse team, noting that lacrosse teams have more players, which equals more tuition for the school, which strengthens the financial picture. I mean, college sports have never been far away from these kinds of discussions. This isn't exactly new, but what does it mean to see women's teams pitted against women's teams in this way?
Well, I think that's been an implement used when Title IX first started evolving, and most colleges and University of Michigan back in the late 70s, early 80s, our own athletic director lobbied Congress against Title IX. Don Canham said, no, this will ruin college football if we have to spend this kind of money on these women, basically something to those effect. And then they didn't want to cut back in any areas of nobody wants to cut back. Nobody wants to see men cut back. I don't want to see the football budget cut back. But are there areas that we can trim the fat to make room for everybody and to give everybody the same opportunity? But what they did instead was just they started cutting men's sports. And, of course, wrestling was one that was really hit hard back in that period. And they were mad. And you know who they were mad at? They were mad at the women. And as I often say, I mean, I grew up in a family. There were three boys and three girls. And I think my mom invented gender equity. And we all got the same opportunity. We all got the same number of Christmas presents. She treated us all equally. And we just wanted what they had, which was the opportunity to get to play, the opportunity to get a college scholarship, to have some of the resources that the young men had. We didn't want their resources. And we have shown over the years that there's a way to take care of everybody. But I think it's just an age-old ploy to pit the women against the women. And, you know, that's what I think of it as a game.
Carol Hutchins is head coach of the University of Michigan women's softball team. We'll be hearing more from her later this month. Coming up, we talk about the cost of activism, personal, professional, and financial. That conversation straight ahead on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Angela Davis's speech at the University of Michigan Monday drew an overflow crowd to Ann Arbor. The renowned writer, activist, and academic encouraged her audience to remember the perspectives on history that may not be represented in a mainstream record.
The agents of history are not so much the leaders and the spokespeople, but rather the masses of people who develop a collective imagination regarding the possibility of a new future.
Davis's story, including her imprisonment and exoneration related to a courthouse occupation in 1970, has inspired many people. We were interested to learn that one of the university events scheduled around her appearance was a storytelling session on the costs of activism. One of those who told the story Monday was Vidya Aravind. For the past 4 years, she's been involved in a range of progressive causes, from anti-war rallies while tensions with Iran were high, to LGBTQ and trans rights issues, to labor organizing. She told us the cost has been real for her. How did you start to get politically active? What set you on your path?
Coming out as trans and being a trans woman of color will automatically do a lot of work to radicalize you, because if you kind of want you and your communities to stay alive, you learn a lot about what you and your communities go through very quickly. And so I came out in March of 2016, picked a great year for it. And then I was doing a lot of like educational work mostly, not necessarily something that people would think of when they think of activism. But then November 2016 happened and I felt like I had to get involved. I felt like the kinds of education I was doing didn't feel like enough, or they were shifting things quickly. And so I dug around on Facebook, and there was a student group called Students for Justice, and I was friends with some of them. They seemed pretty radical, and they were organizing a rally for the next week in defense of DACA after Trump got elected. And so I joined in on that organizing effort, and that's sort of how I first got involved. And it was just a lot of organizing after that, just kind of jumped in the deep end.
Can you give us a range of some of the issues that you've done work on?
Sure. I've done labor organizing, police accountability organizing, trans health and trans community building, racial justice on campus, very active in the campaign to stop Richard Spencer from speaking here, recently helped out in Benton Harbor with the high school closing. I participated in all of the lame duck work that was happening around 2018.
The March 15th climate strike.
I was involved in that.
How does one go from one issue? I mean, intersectionality hardly seems to cover what it is you've been doing.
Sure. It very much is a feeling of like same struggle, same fight. It's not necessarily about seeing the ways that all of them are very specifically connected. It's more that, you know, none of us are free until all of us are free. And I kind of have a unique ability to do like networking and coalition building and some amount of communication work, group facilitation, group mediation, those sorts of things. So I try and bring those to spaces that seem like they need them. And anytime there's like a large coalitional effort in the area, I try and involve myself and help however I can. Rather than thinking of them as distinct issues, I think the way I see it is that like I'm trying to build or participate in a culture of organizing and care that is very inclusive and that brings people in and starts to build a much bigger movement. So I don't see each campaign or rally or project as individual. I see it as part of a very, very large project to build political consciousness and a want for change.
So Vidya, Angela Davis was in town over the weekend to give a speech and encourage people to think deeply about their activism. I don't know that we're ever going to get this question answered by her, but if you could ask her one question, what would it be?
I think I would ask her what her perspective on losing is, because my understanding as an organizer, and I think a lot of the understandings that lots of people have around me, is that like, especially in kind of work to counter existent structures of power, a lot of what we do is losing. And like the way I've thought about it for myself, to make myself like not focus on each individual loss and like, I guess, feel the brutality of it, is that through each losing effort, I'm still building relationships. I'm still educating people. People are still coming together. People are still working hard. That momentum carries forward, even if the individual project doesn't. But it's just so many losses all the time. Electorally, not electorally, anytime you're trying to change structures of power, there's always really, really intense resistance. There's always lots of compromising. So I think I would ask her about that. I would also ask her about how she sees the importance of mutual aid work and like what kind of creative ways that she has to kind of approach and think about mutual aid work, because I think that's, especially in this era of Trump getting elected, a lot of activism focus goes to like our elected officials and goes to trying to change structures of power, and not necessarily a lot goes to building the community resources and the community care we need so that we don't have to rely on those same structures of power. Mutual aid work was very, very important to the Black Panther Party and to a lot of the groups working in the 60s and 70s. And I would be curious how she sees mutual aid work today, if she sees it as like comparable, or like if she sees it as like having dropped off, and what are ways she would like to approach it and think about it.
Getting back for a moment to your question about how to cope with, you know, being on the losing side of things, what has been your way of getting through that?
I really, really try and focus on a longer timeline, the kinds of ways I can build towards something in the distant future. And I also try and focus on kind of understanding scale and scope, especially for losing efforts or for things that, you know, feel bad. We hear about them on like national or international scales all the time. But like even people in Washtenaw County don't know about the efforts I'm doing, for example, to host relationship skills workshops and to teach queer people about how to be in relationship better with each other so that when we need to rely on each other, we can, and we haven't burnt those bridges. There are tiny efforts like that happening all over the world, all over the country. And so I keep trying to remind myself that like I don't know about all the people fighting everywhere, and I just sort of have to have trust and faith that there are lots of people fighting everywhere in spite of all of these big, big losses and big, big existential crises we're facing. And then I try and focus on, like, what does the long game look like? What does it look like to kind of build relationships so that we can care for each other 10, 15, 20 years down the road, even if we lose an electoral fight now?
Are there ways that your life in activism has colored your interactions with other people?
Yeah. So when I first came out as trans, I was very much this kind of, I don't know, very aggressive trans woman of color. I thought I knew everything. I thought I didn't have time for people who didn't know the things that I knew. I didn't really have a good conception of solidarity. And then...
I'm sorry, like what kinds of things?
Like if people hadn't had social justice education before, I wasn't interested in spending time with them. If people like were saying the wrong things in spaces I was in, I was very invested in correcting them. And I was very invested in like everyone needs to be on the exact same page. And the way everyone gets on the exact same page is by me sharing that page with everyone all the time. And like something I learned over time is that you don't build power by being correct. You build power by being in relationship with people, building love and trust. And then when that love and trust exists, they'll learn from you without your having to put effort into it. I think a big example of this is the police accountability work I did in Ann Arbor when that task force was happening to establish the commission that exists now. I am a police and prison abolitionist, right? So like if I had it my way, the work wouldn't have been for police accountability. I don't think police accountability is a thing that functionally works because police themselves are a very oppressive system and the accountability doesn't fix that. It doesn't fix what like the nature and mission of policing is. And so if I had it my way, the activism would have been to like disarm cops or divest from cops or, you know, make less than a third of the city budget cops. But the community and especially Black elders after Aura Rosser's murder at the hands of police really, really wanted police accountability. Like if I went into that space and was just like attempting to be correct or attempting to push police abolition more than just offering it and seeing if people will take it, then I wouldn't have made friends. I wouldn't have been in solidarity with people. I wouldn't have built relationships.
And you maybe wouldn't have heard them.
Right, exactly. And that summer was rough because I was working to fix police, which is work that I don't believe in, but I was working to build relationships through that work. And then at the end of the day, things panned out in such a way that the commission is like not at all what we wanted. Many of us suspect that it won't be able to actually hold police accountable in the ways we wanted, even if we wanted police accountability. It sort of panned out that the fight on the surface was like a loss. But I now have relationships with Black elders in the community who I respect and learn from and who respect and learn from me and who I can talk to about issues. And those relationships are the actual work that doing this police accountability task force was. And when I first came out and maybe for the first year, year and a half of being out, that wasn't something I understood well. But now I really see the goal of any activism is to build care and build relationships, and then you can grow together after that.
Would you say that activism has come with some personal costs for you?
Yeah, personal costs. I think the costs aren't from like activism or the nature of activism itself. I think costs are from the ways that activism exists in our society and the ways that we talk and think about activism. Because like I don't want to dissuade anyone from getting involved, right? Even though like a lot of getting involved hurts and is hard. And I think that only talking about costs without talking about like what we get out of it or how those costs can change in the future and aren't necessarily permanent things is an important thing to do. I think people don't realize that activism is a practice skill. People see you on stage or see you in front of the room or see you facilitating the meeting and don't see the work that you've done to develop those skills. And so because they don't see the work that you've done to develop those skills, they assume that they can't do it and that you can do it. And then the same kinds of work keeps falling to the same kinds of people, particularly women of color in activist spaces. In that way, activism becomes less sustainable. It becomes less of a thing that we can do for a long time. We're not developing new activists. And something I dealt with a lot in my first 2 or 3 years of activism was a lot of burnout because I kept on taking things that were either falling to me or that I felt and was sort of, I guess, kind of conditioned to feel by the ways we think and talk about activism that were like my job or my role.
What do you think it is that makes the difference between people who do step forward to become activists and people who don't? Is it a question of wanting it more?
I don't know what wanting it more quite means. I think it's a question of people who don't talk themselves out of doing it. There's a lot of fear and apprehension of getting it wrong, especially when like lives and marginalized communities are at stake.
And people are outside their comfort zone. Let's just say it. And when white people or straight people are outside their comfort zone.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a fear of getting it wrong. There's a fear of failure. People do a lot of mental work to talk themselves either out of doing things or to talk themselves into believing that the things they're doing are enough. I think we can always not necessarily be doing more in the sense that we should always be burnt out, but we can always be finding more creative ways to like build community, build care, build relationships, and to do more political work. The thing that I've noticed in myself that helps me get involved, it's not quite that I don't have a fear of failure. I do have a fear of failure and I have a fear of getting it wrong. But like I have very little forethought, but in a very positive and useful way, where I don't spend a lot of time on the front end thinking about what the results will be or thinking about what like failure looks like or why it shouldn't be me. I just think about what are the things I'm good at or what are the things I can bring to this space. And then I just do it and then learn from the consequences after the fact. A lot of activism, like I said, is failure and losing. And a lot of activism has to look like creatively throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks. And I think a lot of people are kind of afraid to kind of jump in and try new things and step out of their comfort zone to develop the kinds of skills that we don't learn in school. We don't learn how to facilitate coalitional meetings in high school. And the only way we learn these things is by doing. So I think the thing that happens is there are a handful of people who get this practice because they jump in, and then there are a handful of people who talk themselves out of things, and the people who get the practice become good at things because of the practice and then do things over and over and over and over again.
What keeps you going?
I think what keeps me going is I get a lot of fulfillment from the ways that people tell me that they felt cared for by me, either things I've done or mutual aid projects I've done, or when people say they've learned something from me, or when people have like built relationships because I connected people that needed to be connected. I get a lot of fulfillment from people seeing me as providing some sort of worthy guidance. And that's the kind of thing that keeps me going. And that's the kind of work that I'm trying to do more and more of, is kind of facilitation and coaching and mediation and the kinds of things that help people grow and help people reflect and help people learn. I think something that's true of organizers is that when they jump in, they do everything. And it turns out that we're allowed to like have things we like and don't like. So like it took me 2 years to realize that I shouldn't take on logistical tasks at all because they just make me miserable. and now I try and like push other people to take on the work. So like scheduling or booking or finding food or these kinds of things. And I pick the role that I get the most fulfillment out of, which is watching people around me grow.
Are there places that you can go where you're not the activist in the room?
Sometimes. It's hard. That's another cost of activism that we can talk about, is like people's and even friends' perceptions of me kind of color the ways that I share space with people. But the ways I decompress are basically I have a lot of very close friendships and relationships, and I just spend time with them in like one-on-one or small group capacities doing very low stakes things that have nothing to do with work and nothing to do with checking emails and nothing to do with scheduling meetings.
Such as?
Like to play board games, like to watch TV, like to just sit around my friends and read. Very, very kind of casual, chill, low investment things that I do. And the people I do them with are also all political people. The people I share space with are all people who, in some degree or another, either because they're marginalized themselves or because they're organizers themselves or often both, kind of understand the stress that I go through. And that makes it a lot easier to share space with them. And so kind of sharing space with people and using the relationships I've built up is what I do to decompress.
Actually, I don't know, maybe that would be the closer. Was there anything that we didn't talk about that you think is important to touch on?
Yeah, so the kind of cost of activism I mentioned about perception, right? So in addition to people perceiving me as having some sort of special or unique skill set that they can't achieve and this work falls to me, people also perceive, like, people tend to put organizers on pedestals, and there's this kind of culture of celebrity organizing. that I think really started, as far as I noticed, out of Ferguson and some of the Ferguson organizers who, like...
The Black Lives Matter movement. Mm-hmm,
and the people who stepped up got pedestaled for stepping up. And what that pedestalizing does is that, like, sometimes when I show up in spaces and just want to be at a space or be someone's friend, people look at me and see me as somehow more than them in a way that doesn't feel comfortable. I've had people tell me, like, that they're intimidated by all of the good things they see me doing in the world. And that's not a thing I want. I want to be as approachable as anyone else, and I want to be, you know, have as easy of a time making friends as anyone else does. And it usually takes people some time spent with me to kind of learn who I actually am. But because a lot of the work I've done historically has been very public, people have this impression of what I am that needs to be deconstructed before they can actually build a relationship with me.
That sounds exhausting.
It is, and also it's sort of the nature of the thing, in a way that, like, I don't mind, but I do wish more people thought about critically.
Vidya, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us.
Thanks for having me. This was great.
That's Vidya Aravind. Tomorrow, we'll hear from a conservative activist who's experienced some similar social costs for activism and how she's dealt with them. Coming up, we take a look at how a Montana case being argued before the U.S. Supreme Court today might affect a debate in Michigan over public funding for private schools. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Between 2016 and 2018, Michigan lawmakers budgeted more than $5 million in aid for private schools. That money was meant to help fund state mandates outside of instruction, things like fire drills and safety inspections. But the money was never spent. It was challenged in court by a coalition of plaintiffs, including the Michigan ACLU. Later this year, the Michigan Supreme Court is expected to hear the case and consider whether it violates the state's constitutional ban on public money going to private schools. Michigan's not the only state wrestling with this question. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court hears a separate case out of Montana that could have some ramifications here. With us to discuss the case is Education Week reporter Mark Walsh. Mark, welcome.
Good to be here.
Can you give us a quick overview of the U.S. Supreme Court case, Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue?
Sure. So in this case, it involves a program adopted by the Montana legislature to create a state tax credit. It's a very modest program, $150 tax credit if you donate to a private scholarship fund. And then those scholarship funds pass along that money to students in private schools. Even there's some public school uses under that program. So it's sort of like a voucher program, but slightly different. And quite a few states have programs like this now. And that's what's at issue in this case. The State Department of Revenue said, hey, here in Montana, we have a provision of the state constitution similar to the one in Michigan's constitution that says, you know, we can't provide support for private schools. So we're going to say this tax credit and these scholarships can't go to private schools. Well, then that kind of administrative bureaucratic rule was challenged in court by some parents and families who did want to use their scholarships at religious schools. And then that went to the Montana Supreme Court, which kind of struck down the whole program, said there is this problem with our state constitutional provision really doesn't allow this, and we can't really have the whole program. And now the U.S. Supreme Court has decided to take that up.
If we can pivot just for a minute to the Michigan Supreme Court case, a group of religious and private school groups filed an amicus brief in that case late last year, asking it to strike down Michigan's ban on taxpayer money going to private schools, arguing that it violates the U.S. Constitution's Free Exercise Clause because the amendment was motivated by anti-Catholic bias. This issue has also been raised in briefs supporting the Espinoza plaintiffs for the case before the U.S. Supreme Court. How likely is the High Court to address that particular angle?
Well, I think the court is going to address that issue. It's actually quite, you know, central to the Montana case because there's really no way to save that Montana program or to allow any such program in Montana to be adopted without striking down the state constitutional provision. Now, there are ways the U.S. Supreme Court could take more of a baby step approach to that without saying that all these state constitutional provisions must fall.
There was another significant case involving public funds going to religious institutions that came before the U.S. Supreme Court back in 2017. It's Trinity Lutheran Church of Columbia versus Comer. It found that the state of Missouri could not withhold publicly available grants to faith organizations based on the fact that they're religious. How are these cases changing the national conversation about state bans for funding to private or religious schools?
So Trinity Lutheran, one key difference there, and that was where, you know, there was a program for using scrap rubber to make safe rubberized playgrounds, and a church applied for some of the funds and ranked pretty high and should have gotten a grant, but the state said, well, we just can't give it to a religious organization or to a church in a church school. And in the U.S. Supreme Court in that case said that was religious discrimination. But the court stopped short of saying that that would apply where religious activity was involved, because here it was a playground. But once you get to education, you're getting a lot closer to the question of funding religious instruction and religious activity. And that's going to be much more prevalent in the Montana case. And that could have implications in other states like Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Since the court saw the Trinity case in 2017, Justice Brett Kavanaugh has joined the court, taking the place of Justice Anthony Kennedy. What are court watchers saying about what that might mean for the Montana case?
I think it will be interesting because Justice Kavanaugh, you know, before he was on the bench, had some instances where he was involved in promoting school choice. In Florida, he worked on helping to defend a program that involved just this kind of voucher or scholarship program that are involved in some of the other states. So that doesn't guarantee how he might vote in a particular case. But I think, you know, most court watchers are saying that the conservative side, which is maybe the side you would describe as being in favor of allowing more school choice, more aid to religious schools, probably is starting out in a pretty good spot.
Michigan's constitution bans taxpayer funds going to all private schools, not just religious ones. That's a little bit different than the Montana ban, which speaks specifically to religious schools. But it seems like a ruling of that kind could still impact the Michigan case, right?
Well, I think the ruling could. And that's why I think looking at some of the arguments that have been raised in your Michigan case, I've seen some arguments on both sides. One is that, yes, this is a little different because there's really can be no discrimination here in this kind of aid that you're talking about in Michigan of, you know, for state-required functions, because we require those things of all private schools. So where's the discrimination? And the argument I've seen on the other side is that, well, this whole constitutional provision, which only dates, I think, to like 1970, was animated by bias towards religious schools, towards Catholic schools. Obviously, in Michigan, you have a lot of those. What's most interesting to me about this is your Michigan Supreme Court will have at least the benefit of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the Montana case. And that may help inform your Michigan Supreme Court decision.
Well, Mark, we're looking forward to following your coverage on these cases. Thank you for taking some time with us.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Mark Walsh is a reporter for Education Week. Representing the Michigan Supreme Court case is Dan Korobkin. He's the legal director of the ACLU of Michigan, and he joins us now in studio. Dan, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me on.
So these two cases are very different. The Montana one has to do with a tax credit, and the Michigan case deals with $5 million in direct aid. But they're both dealing with public money going to private schools. How much bearing do you think the Espinoza ruling will have on the case that you're arguing at the state Supreme Court later this year?
Yeah, I ultimately don't think it's going to have a big bearing on the case that we have. You know, in the Montana case, the question is whether the state can fund secular private schools at the same time that it does not fund religious private schools. The Constitution in Montana prohibits public money from being used just for religious schools. And our case is different because the Michigan Constitution, which was this provision adopted by voters in 1970, says that we can't fund any private schools, religious or non-religious. So that's not discrimination against religion. It's a policy choice by Michigan's voters to reserve education funding for public schools.
Would you say that's the key difference between the two cases?
Yeah, that's absolutely central here is, you know, this part of the Michigan Constitution came about when there was a real crisis in funding for public schools. And the purpose of this provision in the Michigan Constitution is to say, look, we've got limited tax dollars, and our tax dollars for education are going to go to public education. So whether you're a private school that's religious or a private school that has no religious affiliation in Michigan, you have to raise your money privately through tuition or through donations from donors, but you can't get public tax dollars. The case that the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing now in Montana is really a case about whether the state can say we're not going to use any taxpayer dollars for religious purposes or religious funding.
An amicus brief that was filed for the Michigan case is asking the state Supreme Court to consider whether the Michigan ban violates the U.S. Constitution because it was written with an anti-Catholic bias. We noticed a parallel argument in amicus briefs for the Espinoza case at the Supreme Court. Do you think it's likely that the case you're working on will bring the court to that question?
Well, I think the Michigan Supreme Court will probably have to take a look at whether those arguments really were developed and presented in the lower courts in this case, and they weren't. So I'd be surprised if the court wanted to take those up as a brand new issue they wanted to look at. But regardless of whether they do or when that issue comes up, you know, the historical record in Michigan really doesn't bear that out. There are historians who talk about the addition of constitutional no funding provisions in other states in the late 19th century and early 20th century that were known as so-called Blaine Amendments, named after a congressman from the 19th century named James G. Blaine. And those amendments are thought historically in other states to be the product of fear and reaction to a larger growing Catholic population in those states. In Michigan, however, the provision that's being debated right now in the courts came into the Michigan Constitution by the voters in 1970. And that election in 1970 and that addition of that constitutional provision was really a completely separate historical situation and was really, as I said, about preserving public funding for public schools. The electorate at that time was very concerned that if public funding was diverted away from public schools, it would weaken our public education system. And they voted by overwhelming majority to keep public funding in public schools. And that's actually what Michigan citizens have decided to do again and again in several elections since then. So the history there in Michigan is completely different from the history that we're talking about in some of the other states.
There was a ruling in 2017 at the U.S. Supreme Court that held a state denying a grant for a playground resurfacing to a religious institution, a grant that was available to secular groups, violated the Constitution. Do you expect that these kinds of challenges to state bans on public money for private schools to keep coming?
Yes, that is the pattern that we're seeing, is that when a state allows public funding to be used for a secular purpose, but then does not allow the same public funding to be used for the same general thing, but for a religious organization or institution, that the U.S. Supreme Court is seeing that as a form of the denial of free exercise of religion or some sort of discrimination against religion. And that is probably what we're going to be seeing the arguments focus on in the Montana case about school funding, too. In Michigan, when we're dealing with public funding for private schools, the Michigan Constitution and the rule that's at issue here does not discriminate between private schools that are religious and private schools that are secular. And so that issue doesn't really come up. But you're absolutely right. You know, we used to have a series of U.S. Supreme Court cases all about the idea that the state has to be very careful about not funding religion in order to maintain that separation between church and state that's at the core of our Constitution. But more recently, the U.S. Supreme Court has gotten more conservative, and they've started to move away from not the rule against funding religious purposes toward a different kind of pattern, which is saying, oh, you know, in some situations, you might actually be required to fund religious institutions if you're funding non-religious institutions for the same kind of thing.
What will you be watching for in the court's decision when it rules on Espinoza?
What I think we're going to be looking for in the Espinoza decision is what the Supreme Court thinks about funding that is going to schools where the actual money could be used for religious purposes.
Not resurfacing a playground or other kinds of capital concerns.
That's right. You know, there's a difference between when taxpayer dollars goes to actually pay a teacher who's teaching a religious class, for example. That's a situation where the taxpayer money is actually being used for a religious purpose and a religious exercise. And there's a difference between that, right, and something where a school building has to get has to have its parking lot resurfaced. And yes, the school building is a religious institution, but you know, resurfacing a parking lot isn't really a religious activity. So we're going to be looking to see if the Supreme Court is, you know, cognizant of that that difference to make sure that that separation between church and state is maintained when it comes to the funding of different institutions and activities.
Are there any potential outcomes for the Espinoza case that could change your strategy later this year at the state Supreme Court?
I don't think so. You know, one thing that we know is probably going to be discussed at the in the Michigan case is the history behind the various provisions in the Michigan Constitution that are at issue. And we'll probably start to get a sense of how much the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court or the Michigan Supreme Court want to delve into the historical record. Right now, in our case, we were just focusing on the text of the Constitution, what the words actually said. But if the justices decide that in the future they're going to be really interested in what the history was behind the different constitutional enactments that came about, that could be an issue in future cases that is going to have to be delved into and developed.
You know, it sounds like you're saying that there might be room within the law for public money to private schools in Michigan for instruction as long as it doesn't explicitly fund religious instruction. That sounds like a pretty big precedent.
Well, that's not the case under Michigan's constitution. You're absolutely right. In some states where the constitutional protections under state law are not as strong, we might start to see courts moving in the direction that you just mentioned, saying that funding could be used for religious institutions but non-religious purposes. But in the Michigan Constitution, it actually says right there in plain text that taxpayer dollars cannot be used for any private schools at all. And so that means it really doesn't matter whether the private schools want the money to pay their teachers, to build their buildings, to buy better chalkboards for the classroom. The money that's taxpayer dollars has to go to public schools in Michigan, not private schools. You know, public schools, they're willing to educate everyone, rich or poor, black or white, gay or straight or trans, Jewish, Catholic, Muslim, Hindu. We don't have that guarantee with private schools, which is why taxpayer dollars should be reserved for public education. That's what the voters of Michigan wanted to make sure of in 1970 when they passed this initiative, and it remains true today. There were measures on the ballot just in the last 10 or 20 years over school vouchers, and Michigan voters have rejected those. And I think that reflects a commitment by Michiganders to maintain public funding for public schools. And of course, if anyone wants to send their child to a private school, whether it be a religious private school or a non-religious private school, that's absolutely their choice. But when it comes to public funding, those should be for public education.
Dan Korobkin is legal director of the Michigan ACLU. Dan, thanks for stopping in today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
That's our show for today. Don't forget to sign up for the Stateside podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or really anywhere you listen. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.